Yep, so I'm recording now.
I'm recording.
Cool. Welcome to the Cinematologist podcast. I'm Dario Linares, and of course, down the line, we have Neil Fox. Neil, how you doing, mate?
I'm very good, Dario. It's lovely to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm even better because we have a special guest for the first time ever on the Cinematologist's studio portion, Dr. Felicity G. Felicity.
Hi, Dario. Thank you very much for having me, and Neil as well. Hi.
Hello. Welcome to the podcast. It's an absolute honour to have you back and for you to be our first kind of infiltrator into this sacred studio space.
I know Felicity's seen behind the curtain and all the kind of ad hoc little problems and challenges that we have, including Skype connection. But I'm sure she'll keep quiet and say how seamless and professional everything all is.
Yes, it's not like Oz at all.
We could always close the curtain over in the edit anyway and keep the facade.
Absolutely. So the reason that we have Felicity on board today, and the reason for this episode, is we are having a special Cinematologist podcast on the films of Claire Denis. And this is to coincide with the release of her latest film, Let the Sunshine In. So it's provided a great opportunity to be able to sort of look retrospectively at the work of Claire Denis. I know all three of us have been kind of overdosing on her work, and to the point now where, you know, it's getting straight what happens in each film is quite difficult. But when we were talking about putting this episode together, Neil, we all decided that I think that the best place to start would be what is perhaps considered her masterpiece work, which is Beau Travail. And you wanted to sort of start by talking about the position that film seems to now hold in what we might call the cinematic canon, and how it reflects the sort of peak of what Claire Denis represents as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to kind of to talk about this with the release of the film. And I think the fact that she's had that film kind of on the circuit since Cannes last year, and then obviously has another one kind of on the way, this new sci-fi film, kind of means that she's in the conversation. And I think that the idea of the canon is constantly shifting and being kind of discussed, as we've covered many times. But Beau Travail seems to be a film that gets a lot of sort of talk now when we're talking about what are the modern masterpieces. I know it's like 20 years old, but what are those new films that are going to kind of stand the test of time and break through? And Mulholland Drive and In the Mood for Love have kind of made their way into AFI and kind of sight and sound lists recently. And the next film that seems to be on a lot of podcasts and a lot of discussions and a lot of pieces seems to be Beau Travail. And I think it's just really interesting that that's a film that kind of has that status. Not undeserved. I think it's an absolute... I do think it's a masterpiece. And I watched it again the other day, and it does feel like, you know, it's just exhilarating, you know, as a piece of work. But I think that the reasons why that's the film are kind of interesting. I think that, you know, we can't get around the fact that, you know, that there is, you know, there is a need to talk about women filmmakers in the canon, you know, and it feels like, you know, this is a film that not will be accepted, but, you know, is like that's what we're going to say next, you know, like we'll bring Beau Travail in because that's by a female filmmaker, which I think is a terrible reason to do anything other, you know, that kind of tokenism. But it feels like a logical choice because it kind of does so many different things. I think it is, you know, an exhilarating piece of pure cinema. It's also, you know, kind of a fascinating kind of film that straddles art house and a kind of psychological thriller territory in really interesting ways. So there's really kind of interesting use of genre, interesting adaptation aspects to it. But of course, it's ultimately a film about masculinity. So I think that's one of the kind of the political kind of, you know, contentions that I have is that, or that I'd like to kind of work through and kind of talk about more is this the film that kind of gets considered, because in the same way that we've always talked about Bigelow's work, because it's so rooted in masculinity, so women filmmakers are allowed into the canon when they make films about men, as a kind of broad starting point, I guess.
I think that's a really good point. And it's interesting, I was reading back over an old interview with Denis, in which she was talking about Bigelow, and she said, "We have nothing in common at all. You know, she's part of the Hollywood industry and I'm not. And we might as well be, you know, it's the same as the difference between a man and a woman filmmaker," which I found interesting, because I often in my head draw comparisons between their work, particularly because of their work in genre and obviously, as you've just said, about male bodies and masculinity. And one of the things that Denis often talks about is how she wishes she or has wished that she could be a soldier or a sailor to escape the mundanity and the tiny problems of just being alive. And I think that really comes across in the film, that we are in this space that's not connected to our reality at all. It is, the bodies are recognisable, we know why they're there, but there's this sense of space and place that's very different. It's very intimate. It's a film that is completely driven by an emotion, envy. And I think the structure of that is just so compelling. That combined with the way the bodies are filmed, the way we get those wonderful shots of the clothes hanging out to dry, for example. And yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating, but just hearing you talk there about that sense of being away from the reality, because obviously it's set following the French Foreign Legion. And in a way, there's a sense in which that environment offers the possibility for the people who give themselves over to being in it. They don't have to deal with the notion of the self anymore, because everything is controlled. You know, it's almost kind of a reduction of everything that you use to define yourself in many ways. You know, whether it's kind of clothes or experiences, it's just you do what you're told, and there is no kind of reasoning behind that. And in a sense, that kind of mirrors a lot what Claire Denis does with her characterizations, in terms of not giving you a lot of context, not giving you a lot of backstory, not giving you a lot of psychological motivations. And I think in a sense what that does, particularly when we're talking about the body, and obviously the word that keeps coming up in the stuff that I've been reading is sensual. And I think that perhaps the reason that that's the case is because we don't connect the bodies on screen to a certain identity or a certain way of being, or, you know, a kind of historical or social background. They're just bodies as bodies, and you have to kind of take them as such. And as a viewer, it just becomes so singular what you're focusing on. And it's much more about the materiality of the skin. And there's almost a sense in which she's one of the few filmmakers, I think, that bridges that distancing that we all tend to kind of get involved with, especially in mainstream cinema, where we're looking at something, you know, with that sort of voyeuristic gaze, you know, and whether that's sexualized or whether it's to do with action or whether it's to do with, you know, clothing and status, all of that seems to get stripped back, and it's simply calling to our experience of what it means to be an embodied person that I don't think anybody else in cinema quite gets to in the way that Claire Denis does.
Yeah, I think that's a really kind of, you know, good way of putting it. And the world of Beau Travail is a world where, which is kind of, it's a, the rules are unto itself, you know, which is very much like her approach to kind of film language and film storytelling. You know, there's a confidence in the way she handles, you know, image construction and temporality and kind of narrative, which is kind of singular, I think, you know, particularly in Beau Travail and I rewatched White Material. You know, there's this, her control of her medium is like she's kind of creating a space for her own set of rules. And I think that's why Beau Travail kind of stands out, because, you know, the context has its own rules, and there's a space for this kind of, you know, it's a liminal space within the military, which has its own rules. And, you know, I just watched Men in War, the old Anthony Mann film with Robert Ryan and Aldo Ray. But there's this really interesting relationship in that which is a kind of this love story between, you know, the sergeant and the colonel, and that kind of the hierarchy. And for such a kind of complex location, such as the military. You know, this is all, it's also, it's envy, but it's also love. You know, he loves his commanding officer in a way that is explored so aesthetically, you know, and it's not, it can never be a kind of actualized homosexual love, because obviously it's the military. But within that space, there is this idea that love between two men in that kind of hierarchical power relationship and that kind of adoration gaze upwards is perfectly acceptable and perfectly free to be explored. And the way the characters encourage that and then just kind of brush it off when it goes too far, I think is really fascinating. And what you're sort of saying about kind of wanting to be in that space and be free and kind of, you know, live in another body, I think is really, is really well explored, you know. And there's, and like I say, there's so many different points to access it, but you always know you're going through her, her interpretation of it, which is deeply embodied. Yeah.
Just before we move on from that question of the canon that you were talking about, I want to ask Felicity about how she sees Claire Denis in relationship to other filmmakers who perhaps, you know, arguably, I mean, we can ask this question, have a sort of higher status in cinephile culture, people like Agnès Varda and Chantal Ackerman. I mean, I don't know. Is there a sense in which she is perhaps less of an explicitly feminist filmmaker, or the fact that there isn't a sort of cultish crossover in the same way as those filmmakers, perhaps?
That's a really interesting question, and it's something I've given a lot of thought to over the years, actually, because I've always been a big fan of Denis. But you're absolutely right, she doesn't get the same kind of adoration that you see around Ackerman, Varda, definitely. And I don't know, I mean, when she talks herself about whether she's a feminist or not, and it doesn't really come down to what someone claims to be or not. What's interesting about her work, I think, is that there's not a dichotomy between the male always being the perpetrator, being bad, being a malevolent force, and switching to have empowered female presence, to have something different happen. Everyone's fallible, everyone's slightly on the wrong side of doing okay in her films. And I think there's a really clear sort of equivalence that's not about male and female, it's about human beings and them, you know, doing the wrong thing, being out of time, being in the wrong space, making the wrong choices. And even I was watching this week again Bastards, and you know, there was such a lot of kind of quite vitriolic pushback at the time, I recall, for her not being feminist enough, for her not giving the victims a voice, and for it being a very kind of cold portrayal of rape and abuse, systematic abuse. And I think that's not what she's trying to do. It's not about that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it's interesting about thinking about Claire Denis in this particular moment. And the sense in which filmmakers and critics and everyone almost have to be on the right side of the argument, the politically correct right side of the argument. And if you're not, you're kind of inviting a lot of criticism. And that in the one hand has its importance and its place. But when you're trying to show three-dimensional flawed characters who may, on the one hand, have suffered oppressions and difficulties, and whether it's female characters or whether it's the colonial characters or, you know, explicit racism that a lot of the characters experience, or implicit racism they experience too in her films. Being able to show those characters as flawed in and of themselves often opens you up to that kind of criticism, as you're not being positive enough about this, about particular identities. And I think that she's very complicated in terms of characterization throughout all her films. And I think that clearly isn't, that lack of simplicity and that nuance and that opening up the possibilities of people having quite contradictory identities and quite contradictory ways of being obviously doesn't fit into the simplistic ideology of being on the right side of a certain debate.
Yeah, it's the beauty of her work, I think. You don't come away from a Claire Denis film really saying, I love that character. you know, there's not the sense that you're really willing for any one person over the other. It's completely complex and nuanced and shifting. And we can't take anything for granted either. And even though people might be fixed into their routines, their jobs, their spaces, they're also complex in their emotions. And I think that's the really interesting thing, where they're fixed perhaps in time and space and context, they're unfixed in what they do.
And the reasons for doing them.
Yeah.
Neil?
She's a messy and unstable filmmaker in the kind of the best sense of the word. Her characters and her kind of approach to filmmaking is shifting, and the characters are messy and contradictory. And we in kind of film culture love a label, you know? And if you can't label her as a feminist, you can't label her as an art house or experimental documentary, then like people, filmmakers like that generally get forgotten because they're not easy to pigeonhole. I think that's why Beau Travail Again is a film that kind of, you know, rises to the top of a kind of that conversation in a way that some of her other work might not, because it's the context means that the emotions are all kind of repressed, and it's in the aesthetic of the film and the pace and the music and the kind of the juxtaposition that she creates formally that kind of comes out. Whereas in a lot of her other work, the messiness and the stability kind of issues are on the surface, and they're worked through in more complicated ways, but they're kind of, you know, more in terms of characters actually having to confront that, you know, more directly, which I think is, you know, it's not easy. And I think that's one of the reasons that I love her films, because they're not easy, you know, and I think that she doesn't get enough credit for that, you know. It's kind of often dismissed as, yeah, kind of, oh, you know, she's not really thought about this side, or, you know, it's like, well, there's no coherence to it, which I think is nonsense. I think they're very coherent and very, very clearly kind of structured in the way that she wants. But it's easier to say that than kind of grapple with some of the really problematic and difficult questions that those films create.
Yeah, and I think that you have to, when you're thinking about Claire Denis, amalgamate any talk of theme and context and just simply subject matter with the aesthetics. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. In a sense, it's that thing, we've talked about it with directors like Keira Starmer, where you almost have to set yourself in the right frame of mind for engaging with the film. If you think about the pacing, you think about the editing, you think about how close-up is used in a very specific way, not in a kind of movie star way. And that is often done on the back of being quite, you know, quite distanced and quite far away from the action, or having the action that is off-center, for want of a better word. And this ties in as also to the kind of the sense of the fractured narrative and the questions of whether she's an experimental filmmaker in the sort of obvious notion of that word. But, you know, clearly her films, they also are focused on quite, you know, normal situations in many ways, but they're broken up in certain ways. And then you'll get a very mundane image that is somehow, you know, spectacularly changed into something almost ethereal and poetic. So, you know, her aesthetics are absolutely key. I mean, you use that word, which is a sort of problematic phrase in and of itself, but the idea of a pure cinema. And I think, you know, I was just reading Judith Main's book about Denis, and she talks about her being, you know, her filmmaking being about the little moments. Upon such moments are built a fascination with human interaction and cinematic vision, is what Main says. And I think that's so true. And it says something about the fundamentals of cinema as well, where so much, when we're watching contemporary cinema, used to seeing massive moments, big spectacle, big action. And that misunderstands, I think, the sort of rawness and the fundamentals of what the cinematic actually is, where because cinema is so big, it can open up these little moments into something massive and something profound. And, you know, that's what Claire Denis's little moments do so perfectly, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think she comes so close to what it means to be alive and to experience little moments, but also in our lives, within the little comes the monumental, mm. just around the corner. We, you know, these monumental things that happen that completely change our lives, where, you know, whatever those might be. So I think she's very clever. And, you know, there's much talk about the ellipsis, the ellipses in her films. And I think it's very important, because in the story, we dream, we are thinking what is missing. We are never given what we want to see as trained film watchers.
Mm.
We think, you know, there's going to be a reverse shot. We think we're going to know what that object, what purpose it serves, or what's going to happen to that character. And then we don't get it at all. And I think it's really important to have time. And whether she's a filmmaker who's a slow cinema filmmaker, I'm not sure. There's a lot that's been written on slow cinema.
Mm.
And does that mean that because she includes moments of slowness, we get long tracking shots, we get films that open onto the sea for ages, we get things that happen that actually don't go anywhere, but they're so meaningful because they give us time to dream. And something that really struck me when I was reading interviews with her is she talked about still photography and how she thinks about the frame. And she says, if you look at a still photograph, it's full of drama. You don't know what's going to happen next, and you don't know what has just happened. And the example she gave, I think, was of a twisted chair in a kitchen. And she said, it's so dangerous. That was the word she used.
Yeah.
Every single moment is full of danger. We don't know if it's coming or not. And I think having intensity and then having nothing is what gives her films this amazing energy.
Mm. Yeah, I'll come to you in a second, Neil, but I think what Felicity says there is so key. I mean, one of the things when I was watching Nanette Ebony the other night, just the switch between the main characters' kind of everyday existence, you know, just going in and out of these shops. So he goes and buys this coffee percolator, and he's having these violent sexual fantasies about this blonde woman who works in a bakery, and it's almost bordering on comedic the way that Denise sort of shoots these fantasies. And but she does this amazing sort of transition from him fantasizing about this woman to the coffee, the sound of the coffee percolating, and almost sort of it becomes this fetish, you know, of the central character. And it's just amazing how we don't see the coffee percolating, we just hear the sound, and then it kind of fades in or transitions into what we're actually seeing happen. It's just so smart and so clever way of I suppose reflecting that sense of the way that we make meaning through memory and through associations, yeah. of what things mean that don't often have that kind of realist connection. Neil?
Yeah, no, I think, I think that both of you are kind of sort of saying things which I was going to kind of mention, which is that rewatching her work, I'm always aware, however emotionally kind of resonant and powerful the stories are, I'm always aware that I'm watching a film. You know, the film is always working. You know, I'm not sure I would class her as a slow cinema filmmaker, because there's so many other things that she's doing, but the slowness is in itself kind of so deliberate whenever it's used. Watching Let the Sunshine In, and there's it's kind of doing things which are part of the conventional cinema language. You know, there's a two-shot conversation at a bar. You know, we go to one character talking, then we cut to the other character talking, and it's the shot we expect. You know, it's a kind of face-on, you know, medium close-up, and then all of a sudden the angle completely changes. Like, it's almost like she's reacting against the form, saying, oh, no, I want you to see the conversation, but I don't want you to see it like the way you've seen it 100 times. And it changes, and it just throws you out. And there's so many ways that she uses film language, you know, to constantly remind us that we're watching films. You know, the use of credits and what happens on an end credit, I think it's just amazing. You know, like, it's the whole thing. You know, it's the whole film. It's not bookended by credits. It's the text is interwoven into the experience. And then I was just thinking about the performers. You know, she's got this repertoire of actors, you know, Gregoire Colline, Alex Damasus, Michel Sabor, Valerie Bruni-Tedeschi, you know, all these people who kind of recur again and again and again to create this sense of a you know, we talked about this with Aki Kaurismäki, this kind of universe, you know, like this is a Claire Denis universe. So on one hand, you've got all these faces which are so rooted in her cinema and they come up again and again and we watch them age. But then that's completely juxtaposed with she uses the icons of French film, you know, Huppert, Binoche, Depardieu, Dalle, you know, Isaac de Bancoli. Like these are monumental figures in that are absolutely French cinema, you know, and she's using them both in the same scene, both in the same film. And it's just, there's such an awareness that, you know, that this is cinema and this is film rather than, it's just kind of overwhelming watching that work kind of back to back. You're like, wow, this is someone who all, you know, all those influences in terms of still photography, literature, you know, kind of music obviously is a huge one, but she's a filmmaker like that. This is a filmmaker who absolutely is kind of in tune with cinema in terms of as a formal way of communicating.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And it's, you know, when you look at her background, being an assistant director to people like Costa Gavras and Wim Wenders and Jarmusch and, you know, various other sort of luminaries of cinema, you get that sense of somebody who's kind of technically trained. And, you know, often we see that, you know, if you think about the history of the way that film has been written about, you know, in terms of auteur and meta and this kind of thing, it's often seen as a kind of criticism that somebody who's a technician is somehow derogatory. But I think she's also, like you say, it's the idea of, you know, you're watching a film. And again, that's something that filmmakers are often criticized about, where you're never kind of immersed into the emotionality of things. And again, maybe that relates to what we were talking about before, where she perhaps hasn't got the plaudits wider that other filmmakers have got. But I think she's definitely influenced by a combination of kind of like the classical tradition of quality in French cinema and also the French New Wave. And I think that interestingly, the way that those things combine is one of the reasons why she has this sort of singular aesthetic that we've been talking about.
Yeah, often the best filmmakers are the ones that can combine, you know, that the art of cinema and the human connection, you know, the ability to get those two things up on the screen. And I think, yeah, that, you know, we give male filmmakers the benefit of the doubt in terms of what their aesthetic choices and styles are, because whereas with a lot of female filmmakers, we assume that it's, you know, they don't really know what they're doing, you know, and whereas we kind of, which I think is hopefully changing, and hopefully kind of Denis will be seen as she should be, which is someone who, you know, if she were a man, would have been absolutely lauded for, you know, the kind of creative risks and the aesthetic choices that she makes and how she's still able to say something profoundly human at the same time.
So that's good. One of, because I haven't been able to get hold of that, and I think that's an interesting place to start, because just reading about it, it's a film that's, you know, grounding her interest in the notion of foreignness, and, you know, more specifically her own background, you know, growing up in the Cameroon, and, you know, then moving to France, and her own sort of feeling of being a foreigner in both of those positions, but then also France's relationship to its colonial past.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's your sort of take on Chocolat as a sort of starting point.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, learning film and learning to talk about film, Beau Travail and Chocolat were up there as films to talk about otherness, and to talk about coloniality, to talk about race, and also to talk about the female, obviously. And what's really interesting about Chocolat, I mean, Denis says it's not autobiographical. Obviously, there's a lot in there that pertains to what she's experienced. And there's a real sense of Africa in the film, it actually really reminded me of traveling in the Caribbean. Totally different, but the way in which she gets across sparsity in the opening scene, where you've got the character France as an adult.
Called France, yeah.
I think the guy that's picked her up says Vive la France.
Yeah.
Great. No, there's a lot going on in the film. It's I would say it's much more conventional narratively. Mm. It's something we've seen before, in you've got the colonial setup, you've got the people who are presumed to be bad and evil and bourgeois and taking advantage of the servants. You've got the servant who is sort of in this liminal space where they're very intimate with the family, but they're also not allowed to be with the family and part of the family. I think it's really interesting having the two generations. Obviously, you've got the love and the sexuality and the kind of frisson between Prote and France's mother. I can't remember her name. And then you've got France watching this. So from the eyes of the child growing up, who then gets to go back at the end, knowing what she knows from having lived in France, from being away, what it meant. And again, like I said earlier about this, it's not, you know, there aren't clear binaries.
I'm just saying, I was going to ask you, because I read that the film, when it first came out, did get criticism for being kind of from a white perspective.
Yeah.
And her perfectly reasonable answer was, well, I can't really make a film from any other perspective. But in a sense, though, I think that from what I've read, and I can ask you whether you think this is true, it almost has the colonialism as a background. And then its characterizations of both black and white are layered in a way that you can see the sort of power relationships within and across those identity positions.
Yeah.
But not being in a kind of stereotyped, the whites are all bad and the blacks are all kind of, you know, noble and good kind of thing.
It comes back actually in 35 Shots of Rum, when the main character Josephine's at university and they're having their talk about Frantz Fanon. And Frantz Fanon obviously said it's terrible for both the coloniser and the colonised. Again, you've got this idea that you can't just take one perspective. And she is a white female filmmaker who grew up in Africa. That is fact.
There is
a perspective that's embedded in how she makes films. But this idea from Fanon that it's everyone involved in colonial structures, no one wins.
No.
Ultimately,
it's
harsh, it's horrible. Power shifts, but that doesn't necessarily mean success or happiness at all.
Neil, how would you say that the kind of colonial theme gets developed when we're talking about white material? Because you've watched that recently.
Rewatching White Material, I didn't find it as satisfying as kind of, I think, because I felt like there was too much going on. You know, I felt like there was too much plot, there was too many threads, and you know, the need to kind of to make everything kind of make sense kind of intruded on the space for thinking about what it was all about, if that makes any sense, you know. So it seemed like there was trying to see it from too many perspectives, you know. There's too many perspectives in it, which I think, I guess, comes from, you know, a kind of increasing awareness of the white position in talking about these things, even though like she has a direct link to that as an experience. There are obviously, you know, there are moments in it which are just absolutely kind of devastating. It's a very bleak film. I think it kind of, you know, in terms of that, almost an acknowledgement of, you know, what you're sort of talking about, the Frantz Fanon idea that, you know, that no one gets out of this, no one unscathed, you know. And it really kind of, I didn't find it a very hopeful film at all, or in any sense. Not that there's hope in, you know, not that there needs to be hope, but it felt like it was a very claustrophobic experience that didn't have, that was still kind of working through a lot of things. And I would have liked more time to, in the way you do in Beau Travail, you know, just more time to sit in it rather than having to move through the stuff. But it's a fascinating work. And again, there's so, you know, there's the use of silence in that film, I think, is incredibly powerful. You know, it's the long sequences without without any kind of dialogue or really any real kind of action, particularly in the first half, are incredibly unsettling. You know, like you say, like the in this space and landscape, and you can't help but feel the history and the and obviously that moment that the film tries to capture.
Mm. It's interesting that you say about the sort of strands and the structure of the film is the thing that's its undoing. And I think if you look at some of her other films that are grounded within a kind of generic infrastructure or kind of generic structure, films like Bastards and Trouble Every Day. I mean, I haven't seen Trouble Every Day, but I found Bastards a problematic film because of those reasons, where I felt that the sort of desire or the need to fit into the kind of the structuralism that the sort of generic overview requires, it meant that she didn't seem to have kind of like full control over that in the way that when her films are left open and they have these ellipses and they're or they're much more straightforward in terms of the grounding of the scenario. That's when she seems to be at her best. But it's when these extra kind of layers of cinematic control that are coming from, you know, these exterior forces are there. That seems to be where her films kind of fall down a little bit. And I felt that with the new film as well. I mean, I don't know if you guys mm-hmm. kind of buy that.
You sort of noted on the thing about, you know, the kind of the noir, and there was a lot written about the noir aspect of it. But for me, it felt more like pulp than noir. You know, it felt more like a base exploration. That's always a difficult thing to pull off and difficult to do with anything else other than pulp in it. And I really like the film because it went through the pulp lens. But I think that unless you go and you're kind of viewing it in that way, and obviously as a filmmaker, she's doing a lot of things to make it hard to see it through that lends a lot of time. It, you know, her experiments with genre are fascinating, but they demand a lot, you know. But obviously the expectation when you're watching anything that's got those kind of really explicit genre connections is kind of a different kind of expectation than what might be more kind of middle brow or art house kind of fare, I guess.
Yeah.
I did love the opening of Bastards, though. It was just so compelling, where there are several threads and they're really striking images. I mean, they're very the Lynchian girl naked walking at night, the ambulance, the metallic warmth blanket. You know, someone's just jumped out of a window, spoiler. but it is at the start of the film.
Yeah.
And you've got that, and that's classic noir, and it reminds me of Lynch or Gregory Crudson's Photographs, for example, in the way it's lit. And I think this was her first digital film, actually, Bastards.
Yeah.
If I might have that wrong. But and then, yeah, I think you're completely right. It kind of does become this pulpy, it becomes very close to the characters and it loses a lot of the tension of that early sequence. And then it ends on the porn film. You get right at the end and then it just cuts. So yeah, it's frustrating in the extreme.
You know, and it's extremely bleak as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, and O'Neill, you sort of highlighted that. And it's interesting kind of watching Nanette and Ebony and 35 Shots of Rum. That's the two I've kind of watched over the last couple of days, and they're probably the most accessible. I mean, I thought 35 Shots of Rum, even though it is very bittersweet and melancholic towards the end, I think that the setup of the relationships, and again, perhaps the notion of the way that that Denis represents the family is something that is perhaps not commented on as much as some of the other elements, but it's certainly absolutely fundamental to the way that she sets up her her films. And I think that there's definitely something about the way in which we all define what the responsibilities of of our roles within certain family structures are, is something that she's interested in working through. And in 35 Shots of Rum, there's just this relationship between the father and the daughter was just absolutely, heartbreaking, really. And it just walks a tightrope to moving over into a sort of more darker, sexualized territory at certain moments. But then there's this point in the middle of the film where the father kind of realizes that, that the daughter isn't a replacement for his wife, and she is going to move on, and she does towards the end. And then you've got the friend who he's got a sort of worker friend who has just retired, and he sees sort of his future being alone. And this, we can spoil it on this podcast. We're not worried about that. But the friend commits suicide, and it kind of leads to this sort of real moment of absolutely, heartbreaking introspection towards the end of the film. And I hadn't seen that one before. And, I always thought Boat Revive was my favourite, but this was just absolutely had me in pieces yesterday.
Yeah, it's my favourite Claire Denis film, for sure. I don't know, have you seen it, Neil?
Yeah, but not for a while, so I thought I'd let you two wax lyrical on it.
Yeah, it's just, I was trying, because obviously I watched it again this week for the podcast, and I'd seen it when it came out at the BFI. And I was trying to recall, what it was about. And I remembered the family. I remembered the relationship between the father and the daughter. I remembered the rice cooker.
Mm.
And I remembered the train lines and the moving in and out of space and how long it took. And that's what I'd remembered, particularly the rice cooker. So I was very surprised to rewatch it. And the rice cooker happens right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And
framed again at the end, isn't it? The second one comes in.
Which is just wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a perfect film because, it's this idea of complexity and these kinds of shades that happen in one day or one moment. And it's such a mess because... Mm. You've got the guy that lives upstairs.
Yeah, the Gregoire Colline character.
Right, that she ends up marrying. But that's a very kind of strange relationship as well. Then you've got Gabrielle, the taxi driver, who's, she's brilliant. She's very straight talking, very direct, a bit like Binoche in the recent film. And... yet the father he loves her, but he's disgusted her or keeps her at a distance as well. And there's all this going on within the same apartment building.
Mm.
It's very, very tense, but it's just ordinary life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can definitely see the kind of Ozu comparisons in terms of the way that they kind of maneuver around each other and the way the camera is positioned to capture those moments in certain kinds of ways. So Neil, we've sort of stated there what our favourite film is. Is there anything that has topped Boat Revive for you, or is that still your kind of like pick of her films?
I think it is, but I remember loving 35 Shots of Rum, and then that, and I didn't get to see it last night, and I am keen to revisit. And I think that's a film that seems to be a lot of people's favourite, and a lot of, it's funny, isn't it? Because when we talk about the canon, often there are films that are put into the canon that are kind of recognised masterpieces, but not necessarily a cinephile's or a fan's favourite, or the things that we think are necessarily, they are favourite, but almost kind of putting the best aside. And 35 Shots of Rum feels like the film that everyone acknowledges is, a perfect film, or, means a lot more to people. But Boat Revive has more obvious things that would put it in a canon. So it's, a loose adaptation of Billy Budd. It's about the military. It's kind of, it's got lots of different, formal things going on. It fits easier in rather than what is a kind of messy, introspective, personal, kind of emotional piece of work in a different way. And I think that's always interesting as well, is like what do we pick out to put in this abstract, list? And what kind of ticks those boxes? But what really, when we kind of drill down and we talk about our personal emotional engagement with a piece of work, would sit on that list? I think it's interesting that they're often very different, very different lists. What is interesting is kind of listening to the conversation and kind of having the conversation. It feels like we're talking a lot about rules and what kind of what stuck with me is like what Felicity sort of said at the start about her want about Denis wanting to escape and flee to, you know, it's like these are films where there are sets of rules that are handed down, common, you know, unspoken, but they're there. And these are films which are constantly interrogating, breaking them down and trying to navigate, you know, what are the rules? You know, which ones do we keep? Which ones do we move? Which one do we, you know, and just so many different ways of approaching that, you know, in terms of the family, you know, and the new one does it. The new one's all about, you know, what are the rules of being in a relationship and being, you know, and finding love, you know, how do we do this, you know, and what happens when we start to speak of how we do this rather than just kind of going along with a consensus that has stood in place for, you know, for so long, be that father-daughter relationships, the family, you know, the family in White Material is, you know, the most broken, disparate, kind of fragmented idea, you know, like this kind of the ex still working with Hubert's character and the son, and then that great moment when she says, oh yeah, you know, he's not my son, he's my son's stepbrother. So you're just like, wow, like that, you know, the how these things go together and what they look like on the surface and what they really are when she kind of drills down, seems like there's a lot that she's kind of interested in, which just I think is why that body of work is so interesting and significant to kind of to go into. Because while I'm not one who says, oh, all of her films are the same, you know, it's interesting at times like this to think, well, why do we gravitate towards this filmmaker and the work, despite superficially Trouble Every Day feeling like a very different film to Beau Travail? And I love Trouble Every Day because, I love Vincent Gallo. So, you
know, where is he?
And I think she photographs him, you know, as a performer, I think she photographs him incredibly well. And again, just, you know, I'm much more interested in seeing filmmakers you wouldn't expect tackle genres and stuff and see that through that lens than anything else. So I'm going to try and watch 35 Shots of Rum and I'll rejoin the conversation at a later date.
It's interesting there that you talk about how well she shoots Vincent Gallo, because I, you know, that's exactly how I felt about Binoche.
Mm.
Like, she looks amazing. She's just so alive in the film. But sort of looking through all her work, and she loves a good cropped close-up, and the skin, you know, almost there next to your own face. And she's interested in how bodies work, in how they make us feel, but not in that kind of Laura Mulvey, you know, freezing the action or voyeuristic. There's something else going on in her close-ups that I find very particular to her. I don't know if you've got any feelings about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great way of sort of pointing, of looking at it, I think, in terms of what she's trying to do with the body and also with sexuality. And maybe we can sort of talk about that and sort of segue on to Let the Sunshine In, because, I mean, that's one of the things you immediately, you know, notice about the Juliette Binoche character, and it, you know, the way she's dressed, the way that the sexuality is clearly this underlying preoccupation with the character, and there also obviously with the filmmaker, but it's to certain ways of looking, you could say that she's being presented in a certain sexualized way, which is about the male gaze. So then you're wondering, does she have ownership over this sexuality, or is the film trying to say something about the way in which women are asked to, or, you know, interpolated to present themselves for men? Because obviously she's throughout the film, she's kind of with, on and off with this real bastard of a character, the older guy.
He's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. And then the actor is not much better, you know. And it's really interesting about that sort of presentation of the body in this particular film, which kind of is doing something that I think that the other films aren't, in terms of what we were talking about earlier, in terms of just letting the body's sensuousness speak for itself. I think there's definitely some coding going on here, which I haven't seen as much in her previous work. I don't know what you thought about that, Neil.
Yeah, I love the way Let the Sunshine In was shot. And one of the notes I made in my sort of notebook as we were going was, that red leather jacket, which was just, that was literally the note I made. There was something so striking about it. And, it made me, you know, I think this idea of the gaze and who's looking, you know, and difficult to unpack it in any kind of really thoughtful and intelligent way, but she looks at bodies, male and female, in such an interesting and specific way. But is it just interesting and specific because it's rare for a filmmaker, a female filmmaker, to be given the, not to be given, but to take the space and take the time to look in that way? And is it just, is it a lot to do with, we're not just not used to seeing that kind of eye trained on the body, because we're so used to the way men look at men and the way men look at women, that it, that, you know, that it's both, you know, I don't want to detract anything from her because I think she's an incredible, but you know what I mean? It's hard to get at, you know, like it is striking. And you know, you particularly Beau Travail, because it was the first film I saw of hers, and there was something about knowing that this was a woman looking at men in this way, which made me kind of look at it in a certain way, you know, because I'm interested in, like, and it just looks so, I just, you know, I don't know whether I can't imagine a man looking like that, or whether it's just because it's Claire Denis. I know I'm being a bit confusing, but I think it's, there is something in asking, what are we actually seeing, you know, and is it the specific filmmaker, or is it just the lack of other filmmakers doing the same thing who've been given the opportunity to make these kind of works? She's interested in, you know, the bodies and takes the time to explore them almost in kind of stubborn way, you know, the way she's very stubborn in the way she makes her films, I think is brilliant. You know, she doesn't want to do what's expected. So that is, that's always kind of exciting. And that's why I'm always interested in seeing her films, because I'm interested in seeing how she's going to look at this stuff. You know, and I think that's kind of, you know, and that's what I loved about Let the Sun Shine In. How's she going to look at this, and how's she going to take Binoche through this? And I just thought it was beautiful to watch in that sense.
Yeah, it's funny because I think if it wasn't Claire Denis, and I didn't have that sort of positive prejudice about what kind of a filmmaker she is, I probably would have disliked Let the Sun Shine In a lot more than I did. And I just sort of, I found myself watching and thinking, so what is going on here? What is going on here? And like the sort of theatricality of the film, and the way that Binoche is kind of a character who seems to be unable to sort of construct a sense of, you know, and construct a sense of herself that is outside of these ways of behaving that she seems to be kind of shaped by, and you know, they always lead to nothing. And obviously you get that hilarious scene where she's on the bridge where all the men are kind of yapping on, and she, you know, just sort of loses it and sort of, everything is yours. And I think there's that sense of being completely kind of cut off from any sense of the real self. And I mean, you mentioned the leather jackets, it's the boots for me, and the way she's sort of struggling to get them off, it's almost like a comment, like saying, look what I have to fucking do, you know what I mean, to sort of present this sense of self. And I think there's sort of interesting moments about that, but I did find it kind of, you know, it sort of tipped over into the realm of kind of ridiculousness, especially when sort of Gerard Depardieu turns up. So I think there's lots to like about it, but again, I think it suffers from some of those things that we've talked about earlier in terms of her genre films. I mean, I don't know what Felicity thinks about that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any preconceptions before I watched Let the Sunshine In. And as you say, Neil, it's very, you know, you're very aware of the cinematic conventions that are being used. But in terms of how Binoche is being filmed, I think it's really important to think about, you know, this is a female gaze on women, and what we presume about women looking at women is really interesting. And there's a lot going on here that we could presume things about the way she's dressed. You know, it's the patriarchy, and in order to be a woman of a certain age and to attract the right attention, i.e. to get someone to sleep with you in a bar, you have to dress a certain way. And there's this constant dichotomy throughout the film about the fact that she is intelligent, she reads a lot, and she's an artist, against what she's choosing to wear, And as you say, you know, these ridiculous boots that are just, she like throws them off at one point. And the film starts with what you think is going to be female pleasure. There's a real close up of Juliette Binoche's face, and she looks like she's having a great time. And then we realise that the sex she's having with this partner is pretty awful, and yeah, she's not getting anything from it at all. And basically she's not getting anything from any of the relationships.
No.
Which is why it's so hilarious when Gérard Depardieu and the credit sequence, and basically, you know, you've got, he's holding whatever crystal
over
the photographs. And, you know, isn't it like that?
Yeah. Couldn't it's like it love. It's just total bullshit. You know what I mean? You could say anything, and it would be kind of, if it becomes right from your own perspective, then it's right. And if I think what's interesting as well, it's fascinating how she has the terrible sex with the old guy at the beginning, and you know, it's just, you know, you're thinking, why are you with this guy? And then she goes to the actor and has the amazing sex, and then he, you know, blows her off the next day. So neither of them work in that sense. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, and I think it reminded me how much she is, you know, for want of a better phrase, she is a sort of existentialist filmmaker, where, you know, the characters are searching for their own sense of authenticity, as we all are, and what does it mean to exist, and what is your real self? Do we ever really reach that, and the kind of games we play to, and the stories we tell ourselves about what it means to be the person that we think we are. I think a lot of those are being interrogated in the film.
She constantly goes on throughout the film saying, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I've had enough.
I really enjoyed it because I enjoyed how messy it was, and how, you know, kind of by design, really, I think, and how, yeah, just how hard it is to, the problems of language and how hard it is to say anything, particularly to people who, you know, don't really say anything or are only interested in saying things about themselves. And, you know, by the time Depardieu arrives, and I love that scene with Depardieu, I just thought it was brilliant. It was so funny. And, you know, he's trying to tell her that he basically wants to take her out. You know, like, if you wait, someone with all these qualities, which I'm telling you I have, but she's exhausted. He is the one, and rather than Depardieu just come out and say, I'd like to take you out for a drink, he's kind of, it's just fumbling around with these crystals and then like constantly trying to, oh, it's just brilliant. And I love the way, obviously, the credits are coming in and almost the film.
And she's like, what? You know, it's funny.
It's like the filmmaker, like she's saying as a filmmaker, like, you know, we're done. But Depa just like, well, hang on a minute. And Binoche is like, really? I don't know what's going on. It just kind of plays itself out. And, you know, I just thought it was brilliant. I thought it was funny and kind of astute, but yeah, just, you know, a filmmaker working through a lot of things, some of which landed really well and some I thought were not. But overall, I just thought, yeah, kind of how you could just see Binoche's character starting off kind of, you know, fragile and just being worn down by a real inability to have any kind of meaningful relationship, even a meaningful conversation, you know, with anyone. And I just thought that was brilliant.
Well, I think that just about wraps it up. I mean, we've gone through quite a bit there when it comes to Claire Denis. I just want to say thank you so much to Felicity G for joining us.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Well, I hope it hasn't been too stressful. I just wanted to say you've got a book coming out in the next year or so, is that right? Magic Realism and the Avant-Garde in Exile?
Yes, in the next 3 months it has yes.
Brilliant. Oh, well, maybe we can have a chat about that when we do something avant-garde, magic realist at some point. I'm sure we will.
So likely.
No, well, we do all sorts of us. And Neil, have you anything to say to round us up?
Thank you very much, Felicity. That was great. Really, really great to have you on. We will definitely have you back to talk about your book, and you can pick what we look at and guide us through that world. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there, you know, who'll be really interested in that. We didn't really talk about the music.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah.
But that's okay, because what I will do when I edit it, and people will have already heard this, is I'm going to lace it through with some of the brilliant Tindersticks music that has featured across her work. So that'll be kind of interspersed across, and all the credits will be on the end, because That's a whole other podcast, I think. Yeah, really great to be able to kind of have this kind of deep dive into the work and be able to, bring someone else into the fold to kind of really, really kind of valuable and interesting perspective on it. So thank you for that. And good to talk to you as ever, Dario.
So you can reach us, of course, on the usual avenues. So we're on Twitter, on Facebook, on email. And also, of course, our bonus material now goes out on the Patreon page. So if you've got $2.50 a month and you want access to all of the content that we produce now, then head over there. As always, we're really appreciative of all of our audience, but particularly if you support us in that way. Until next time, thank you very much for listening. This has been the Cinematologist Podcast.
Look into my eyes, you see trouble every day. It's on the inside, so don't try to understand. Get on the inside of you. You can blow it all away. Such your slightest breath. And I know who I am. And they scream it out loud. I get on the inside of you. You can wave it all away. Set your slightest thing. It's just a raise of your hand. And this trip every day, this trip every day, this trip every day, this trip every day. Become night, before the year become light. And this trip, you know, every day, please make it stop. This trip, every day, this trip, every day, this trip, every day. Words I can't say, words to find, this trouble every day. Yes, this trouble every day, this trouble every day.
Thank you.